Join us for Mountain Land Physical Therapy's 7th Annual Running Summit Conference, which will take place on September 29th and go through October 1st, taking place in Awesome Park City, Utah. Led by the experts in the field of running medicine, the Mountain Land Running Summit will give participants a deeper look into the common issues regarding runners' health and the innovative treatment plans now available. Participants can also earn up to 12.5 CEU credits and can enjoy various recreational activities in Park City. Early bird pricing available, so buy now. Welcome to episode 72 of the Mountain Land Running Medicine Podcast. This is Jeremy Stoker, and you might think, this is a little weird. Where's Brian? Well, we're throwing a little spin into this today. Brian is actually our special guest, and it's been a few years since I put this bug in his ear on, hey, you know, maybe one day we should interview you. And I don't know if the stars aligned or what, but today he is letting us have a little poke at him. And you've heard him kind of the pokes he's taken at me. So hopefully we can get a few jabs at him today. So Brian, welcome to the show. How are you?
Are you talking to me, Jeremy?
Hey, Brian, what's going on, man?
Hey, Jeremy, how are you, man?
Good. Well, summer's well underway. Have you had a good summer?
Yeah, I can no complaints on this end.
Good. Glad to hear it. I should have expected that you probably would have thrown something back at me anyway. So glad to have you on, and looking forward to this podcast and picking your brain a little bit. We've had some awesome guests on this, as you are aware. And so I think that I don't want to be too rude, but I'm just teasing. We've got you're right up there with all the guests, Brian, and we're excited to have you. So this is good.
I was just gonna say you're gonna make it an impossible podcast for me. I'm not sure I'm gonna be able to live up to the prior guests. We've had some phenomenal guests. You're right. I mean, absolutely stellar. And hopefully they'll all come back on again as future research comes out. But I'm gonna do my best to carry the torch.
No, you'll do great. And I really mean that. It's fun to have you. And I hold you high and in your work and as a mentor to me. So I appreciate that. But as a way of formality, and don't forget to send any questions and feedback to podcast@mlrehab.com. We do any insights you have for us, suggestions, future opportunities. We want to hear them of guests. So please send them our way. But let me give you an introduction here to Brian. He is the Frederick Gainsland Professor in Orthopedics and Vice Chair of Research for the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation. He is the founding director of the UW Health Runners Clinic, director of research for Badger Athletic Performance with UW Athletics, and co-director of the UW Neuromuscular Biomechanics Laboratory. Dr. Heiderscheidt's research is aimed at understanding and enhancing the clinical management of orthopedic conditions, with particular focus on running-related injuries. Support for his research includes the NIH, NFL, NBA, and GE Healthcare. He is editor for the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy. So without further ado, Brian Heiderscheidt, here we go. So Brian, as kind of I mentioned, you know, we've been wanting to get you on here and pick your brain for a little while. And I'm hoping one of the things we can kind of merge today and get your thoughts and opinions on is maybe this researcher versus clinician kind of idea and concept. I can't tell you how many continuing education course I go to and of yours. And I come home feeling like, oh, I've got all the answers. This is ready. We know exactly what to do. And then I come and I'm like, that wasn't exactly right, you know? And so really want to pick your brain on, like, what does research look like? How does that inspire? Where does that go? But before we get to that point, let's back it up a little bit. Talk to us about how you are here. What got you interested? Why are you in kind of the running research? What still keeps you there? What still drives that for you?
Good question. I'll do my best to answer it. I think that what got me here to start with was just an interest in research overall. You know, I did not start my research career knowing that running medicine and running research was what I wanted to do. In fact, the very first paper I ever published while I was in PT school, which at the time was undergraduate degrees, I published a shoulder training trial. So I was upper extremity, and that was my plan, was really focused in that area. And I I knew I liked biomechanics, and my advisor and ultimately the university I went to for my PhD was the University of Massachusetts Amherst, working with Joe Hamill, was my advisor. And Joe, as most people recognize his name, he's phenomenal in the area of running biomechanics. I mean, he's internationally known. He's probably one of the best researchers we have in that space. And he's contributed a ton to that area. But of course, I was young and naive, and I figured, well, biomechanics, that's all right. If he's good at running, I could probably have him. He can help me with shoulders too.
Pretty similar.
That's right. And as any of you know, when you do your PhD, your advisor's research program is not going to change. It is what it is, and you need to mold into that. And thankfully, he got me rolling on an area of research regarding running mechanics that had an injury slant to it, which is also important to me. And we started doing more and more work with runners and in running related injuries. But again, it was running biomechanics. It wasn't necessarily treatment interventions or care or management, but that ended up being a part of my dissertation, was trying to understand pain and running mechanics and how the two intersected. And what I realized was that this was a wide open area. You know, at the time I was not a runner. I still don't consider myself a runner. I run, less and less, I think, over the years. But at that time, I wasn't running at all. I was a ball sport athlete, and running was punishment for not hustling in practice. But I started to run more to help relate to the research that I was doing and to the participants that I was working with, which I think has really helped me understand the issues that they were facing more and better be able to relate to them, and as well as come up with better questions to ask as part of the research. So long the short of it is I enjoyed the running research. I felt that I could contribute in a meaningful way to it, and I stayed with it all along over the years. You know, not necessarily the same exact line within running medicine. And we've had a variety of deviations, and not all my work is in the running medicine arena, but that definitely makes up a large part of it.
Yeah. And you've definitely had a lot of good contributions to the world, and continue to drive it, even with this podcast and trying to help get more word out. But we've had a lot of guests on here that I guess started with running themselves. And I thought that you were going to say that's how you got started, is you were trying to beat that 4-minute mile and you were right on the cusp there and just could never get it. And so that's why you started into it.
Not a chance. No. If I could beat the 12-minute mile, I was pretty happy.
Okay. So you're not known for your speed. Well, let's move on from that. Okay. No, but what sort of evolution have you seen just within the running medicine world and research? Like what sort of things have you seen that you feel have been good changes that, have kind of helped, not necessarily, I mean, within your own research, but then just in general, like you said, it was wide open when you started. What kind of evolution have you seen with this? Yeah. And what do you feel with that?
I think probably the biggest thing is that the quality of the studies, the design of the studies, and what I mean by that, are much stronger now than they've ever been. And this is largely due to the advances in the technology that we have that enables us to capture more data more quickly and reach a broader audience than we could have before. You know, when I did my dissertation and we were doing whole body biomechanics collections with markers on individuals, it was pretty old school. I mean, it wasn't as bad as hand digitizing, which my advisor always described that was his work. You know, I sound like the old curmudgeon here, like, you know, back in my day. Uh-huh. But, you know, it took so much time to process the data and, you know, hours and hours of work for one individual that it was very hard to do, to get a lot of individuals through. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the equipment was extremely expensive. Not that it's really cheap now, but it's definitely cheaper in today's biomechanical type studies. So the biomechanical technologies advanced allow us to capture much more data. So we have, instead of, you know, a study with 20 or 30 individuals, we now have studies of routinely with 75 plus individuals, 100 plus individuals. And whether that you use markerless mocap or you're using GPS and IMU derived measurements, you know, it's really opened the door for other areas of both in terms of the number of people that you capture, but also what type of environments are you capturing them in. The use of I mean, the wide openness of the internet and cell phones has enabled us to track a tremendous amount of information. And so where surveys can be done on a mass level, running watches and being able to aggregate information from that is being done on a huge scale. I mean, there are studies out there now that are, you know, 50,000 plus individuals where we're seeing what they're doing. So it's not as if we don't necessarily have all the answers now, but boy, the potential is really attractive.
Yeah, that's fun. And you probably understand that being the researcher and being in that a lot more than I do and appreciate that. You know, it's definitely one thing that, you know, you talk about a study of 75 compared to 20, and probably the processing of that data is half the time and they're getting, you know, four times the participants, you know? So yeah, that's great. So does that sort of thing, is that the new technology and all that kind of stuff that you're seeing, is that get you continue to be excited about this world of research?
Yeah, you know, it's less about getting excited about the technology. It's more about getting excited about what questions the technology allows us to answer. Yeah. That's what keeps me going, because it's like a lot of the areas, a lot of the questions are always, you know, if you are always answering the same level of a question, it gets pretty boring after a while and you only have small contributions to it. But when you can start to really open up an area that you thought was like, wow, that we're not going to be able to answer this very quickly, but then you start to be able to gather that sort of information, like having data sets where you can start really doing some multivariable modeling to be able to determine contributions, you know, not just what's the effect of X on Y, but what's the effect of, you know, UVWX on Y, you know, putting all these together as it relates to a particular outcome of interest. And in this case, injuries are a big area, you know, and whether it's looking at how we can best treat the injury or screen for the injury, you know, that's what everybody wants to do. Can we screen? Because then if we can screen, then maybe we can prevent, right? And screening is always a challenge, because in order to do that, you have to have big numbers of people to start with, depending on what you're trying to screen for, you know? So that's why so much of the early work in running literature, and rightfully so, was around knee pain. I mean, we know knee pain is a common injury for runners. And so you knew that if you studied knee pain in runners, which is what my dissertation was, you were going to get a lot of people with knee pain, right? You're going to get quite a few of them are going to develop that within your follow-up period of 6 or 12 months. But when you start to study something a little more rare, like let's say a sacral bone stress injury, how many sacral bone stress injuries have you seen in your career?
Yeah, maybe one. There was maybe one.
Exactly. And so, you know, when people say, well, why don't we understand sacral bone stress injuries better? Because they're pretty darn rare, and right? And so it's impossible to do a prospective study on them necessarily, unless you start to narrow down to certain populations that are more at risk. And we know that these are more common in collegiate level or high level elite runners. So if you target that group, we might be able to see a greater number of them. But even in that high level, or even in that population, they're still relatively rare. So we have these big gaps that are going to be there for a while, just because we don't have enough of the injured population to be able to make any sort of advances.
Yeah. So you've kind of hit on this a little bit. Now, you kind of talked about like the right question, or getting the right question, developing the right question, and how that's been able to change over time and what kind of questions you can ask. And I think, you know, being like a clinician primarily, like, what that's kind of where the gap comes. You know, we like that question, like you said, like, why don't we know more about sacral stress injuries? Like, from our standpoint, we're like, yeah, why not? I mean, it's easy, you ask the question and here's the answer. So maybe help us describe or understand that process a bit more, and why this does develop over time, and why does this take so much time for us to kind of get to some sort of conclusion that then we can apply in the clinic?
Oh boy, good questions. I think you may have stumped me on a way to succinctly describe this. But I think, I mean, in general, when you always want to ask a question that's meaningful, first off, right? That has relevance and that does contribute to the field. So that question needs to be one that has value, but also one that's answerable, right? You don't want to answer a question that you can't answer.
Yeah.
So you always, to do that, to help define your question, you're reading the literature, you're aware of what's been done before, you understand the clinical importance of it, and that helps you specify your question. You might have to constrain it a little bit, or modify it, or focus it down to a level. You know, everybody wants to go out there and hit that home run and get this major thing that's going to, you know, cure running injuries. It just doesn't happen, right? It's always little pieces that ultimately are going to build our success. And so once you come up with that question, then it's a matter of, okay, how do you best answer it? How do you answer it? And a question might not be answerable because, one, you don't have access to the population, right? It may involve areas or interest or an injury type that you don't even see in your practice or have ability to recruit. So now you got to figure out, okay, who is this going to be relevant to? How do I get access to them? And then the most important piece to it is, how do you pay for the study, right? It's just like any other clinical enterprise, research enterprise is the same idea. You have to pay for the costs associated with it. And you can say, well, you just do it with an academic institution. The academic institution expects the researchers to pay for the research, right? The academic institution doesn't hand out dollars to do this research. Occasionally they do. I mean, there are small pockets to get things started, but to do the types of studies we're talking about that are going to advance the field, you need outside support. You need external support, and they can be easily on the order of several hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on the scale of your study. You know, and we're not even necessarily talking about equipment costs. That a lot of that might already be taken care of, but you got to pay for personnel to do the work, and you got to pay for the participants to be involved. You know, oftentimes they want something out of it. And so that's probably the most obvious challenge is how do you pay for the work to get done? And, you know, again, unfortunately, it's not easy to find a funding body that's willing, that has a few hundred thousand dollars laying around that wants to put it toward running injuries. And so then you get the issue of, all right, do I work with industry or not? And I'm a big proponent of industry-sponsored work or working with industry on an investigator-initiated research, provided the right constraints are in place to make it completely ethical and transparent, and that there is, that you remove any potential for conflict or bias. But, you know, they're the ones who may have a vested interest in an area of work to get done. Yeah, they, as an industry, they may want the question to go a certain way, but as long as they're willing to take a chance to hand over the dollars to an independent third party to do the work the right way in a non-biased way, then it will contribute ultimately to their area of interest.
Do you find that process, getting that third party or that I guess more non, I guess the NFL,
yeah,
getting the NFL, for example, getting them to come and to support you, is that quite a process? I mean, is that pretty difficult to say, this is where we're looking and we're going to try this. This is how we need to do it and kind of move forward that way. Like, how does that play out?
Yeah. So I can't speak to the NFL. What's important to the NFL.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. What we had done in terms of getting our support for our current large-scale hamstring study was the NFL put out a call for proposals, which is, they basically put out an announcement saying, we want proposals to come to us that are going to address hamstring strain injuries. And these are the general areas that we want researchers to address. Here's the amount of money we have available. Here's the rules of applying. Go for it. Apply.
Okay.
And so that's what we did.
Okay.
It wasn't a matter of talking to so-and-so and talking to so-and-so, yeah, and talking to so-and-so and getting, uh-huh, a check sent our way. It was a very formalized review process. There was a independent scientific advisory board that the NFL had put into place that was independent, like I say, of the NFL and reviewed all the proposals that came forward. Now, that's one scenario. There are other examples of working with industry where it is, hey, I'm doing some research that might be of interest to you. And it turns out it is of interest to them. And so we develop a proposal and float it to them. And if they choose to fund it, then that's great. But the idea is that we're doing research that advances the field and may help benefit or may contribute to, the industry side of things, but we do it in a way where there is no influence from the industry, mm-hmm, on the data interpretation or capture.
So shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
I kind of, in my mind, there's times as a clinician where you might see a patient and you prescribe something and they come back the next time you see them and they have had a notable difference. Mm-hmm. And you kind of feel like, yeah, that was awesome. It just felt good to be able to be a part of that. What findings in your research that you've done, where you feel like that was awesome? I can't believe we stumbled upon that. That is just so cool. I'm glad we figured that out. What are some of those things that you've kind of found that just feels like, yeah, boom, baby?
Boom, baby. I don't know if I've ever felt that.
No, but, boom, baby.
But there are a few for sure. I mean, and you're right. They're fun. I mean, then that's like makes your week, yeah, if not longer, when those things happen. And, you know, for myself and for our group, you know, the important thing is, I think that what you said in the beginning, this concept of separation of researcher versus clinician, I've always tried to avoid that. And I always consider myself both, that I am a researcher and I'm a clinician. Am I in clinic as much as you are? Absolutely not. No way. I mean, you see way more patients than I do, but I am in clinic enough to appreciate how they're presenting, to understand the practicality of any research solution I may come up with. I can understand, is it feasible or not in a clinic setting? And to be able to understand the value of the information to the runner and what's meaningful to them. So our research program and my clinic program are absolutely integrated, mm-hmm, where a lot of those pearls have from either it's a research pearl that we've applied to clinic practice or vice versa. The two have just absolutely fed back and forth. And, you know, for me, I think I'll start with maybe more big picture pieces rather than getting into some details, but I can give you certain examples of it. But for me, I think the biggest thing is number one, you don't need to overcomplicate the process. You know, so many times we're digging down, right? We're looking for that zebra, right? We hear a hoof print and we're digging, we're looking for that rare bird that's going to pop up and find something. Or, you know, we always use the thing, well, something this small could be really important to an athlete at this caliber. It could be, but there's a good chance that's not, right? And so, and I'll go to that level once I've ruled out all the other obvious, more substantial things that are true for any caliber of runner, right? I mean, the basic stuff of their injury history, their training volume, their training approach, you know, their overall strength, their physical capacity, you know, check the boxes on the big pieces first, and you'll probably nail 75% of what's out there, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, but how you do that is, and how you go about doing that is the real art, I think, of what we do. And related to that, I think an important piece is the need to establish expectations up front, you know, with their patient, you know, mm-hmm, so much of the time. And for me, honestly, if you think about how I manage tendinopathies now versus say, yeah, let's just say 6 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago at the tops, I'm not sure I'm doing that much different, but I think I'm getting better outcomes from it. And a lot of it has to do with that first visit in clinic and how I set up this like preamble of, this is what I need from you. This is what you can expect. This is what's going to be important in your care, is there. This is the timeline of progression. And what we're looking for is how you do is going to affect your overall prognosis. I don't dangle out there and say, you're going to be better in 6 weeks and you're going to be nailing it. You're going to be pain-free. No, that's crazy, right? I mean, and then you look like a fool in 6 weeks when they're only 20% better, mm-hmm, or no better, mm-hmm, at all. So it's setting the realistic expectations up front, and knowing who your target audience is and the time frame anything you can do to promote that adherence piece to it. And then, of course, listening to the patients and understanding what it is that they're telling you that has real relevance to it. And I've shared this story with at a variety of lectures I've given in the past, but, you know, people ask how we started getting into step rate. And our early work, you know, from 2011, 2010, that we published on step rate manipulation, that completely came from a patient who came in and said her knee pain disappeared when she ran faster, which again, when we know knee loads and running speed go up, you know, as running speed increases, knee loads increase, but her pain was decreasing. And so, right, if you start thinking about her running form, we did a video of her at running faster when she was pain-free versus running slower when she was in pain. And we just tried to kind of did a simple compare, contrast, non-scientific, just very, you know, anecdotal kind of qualitative description of what was different between this and that, and started to do some adjustments to focus on the form change, and realizing that we could get those same sort of changes if we just manipulated step rate as our teaching tool to create those form changes. But that was completely out of out of a clinic practice, out of a patient. That wasn't, you know, reading literature and deciding, hey, I think we should investigate step rate manipulation and really characterize its effect on knee load. That was completely out of patient care.
Nice. Those are good. Those are good high level kind of overall things. I don't overcomplicate, establish expectations and listen to the patient. That's the take home from this podcast. There's the three things from Brian Heiderscheidt right there.
Well, the problem is you can look at it and say, well, that's not specific to running medicine. It applies to all patients, and it's absolutely true. It does. Yep. It does apply to all patients. And that's kind of the take home that I'm heading for, is that running medicine, it's medicine for runners, right? That doesn't mean that the rules of good care change, right? Just because it's running, it's knowledge about running and it's knowledge about the injury mechanism and how do you get patient buy-in to it? Because each of us pretty much knows a lot of the science that's out there and knows a lot of the treatment and management approaches. So much of what we do in terms of the success is, can we get the patient to do what we're recommending them to do? Can we convince them that this is what's important and to adhere to the plan that you're mapping out for them?
Yeah. No, that's really good. And obviously I think the more we practice, the more we realize that the amount of time we see them in the clinic, no matter how much that is, really isn't enough to make a change in their world unless they adhere to things outside of the clinic that we prescribe, either do or don't. So
that's exactly right. It's either do or don't, right? We're not saying just follow us on the constraints we put into you. No, we want you to do things and mm-hmm. make sure that you do them, mm-hmm. you know, just like avoid certain things, but make sure that you do load and follow the plan that we put in front of you.
Yeah, no, that's good. And so, I mean, we are kind of getting short on time here, which this has gone by way fast, but, maybe to that, just your thoughts and you can use some of the research if you want, but also just kind of your clinical experience, which I appreciate the fact that you try to be in the clinic as well as a researcher. And what is that? What's the hybrid? A clinician and a researcher? Is that where you are?
I refuse to comment on that. I want no part of this conversation.
So with regards to the loading, I think sometimes we get people who are scared, like I don't want to run, it hurts every time I run. Yeah. But they want to run, you know, but they don't want to try it and things like that. I mean, I think we found and we're seeing more that the appropriate amount of load is important. Mm-hmm. That to do nothing doesn't make the change that we're looking for. So how do you guide someone in that? Like, what's, you know, if someone, they really haven't ran for, let's say, even a year or two or more, but they really want to get back into running, they feel so worried about hurting, but what's kind of your general guideline on a minimum frequency to be able to engage in some sort of loading, whether that's running, walk running, or appropriate exercises? Okay, let's move into this.
Oh boy, that's such a gray area. It's hard for me to give any specific advice on how to handle that without knowing the specifics of that N of one who's in front of you, right? Because yep. It varies quite a bit.
Yep.
And I think that's probably the most important part is don't just take a template and give it to every single one of the runners.
Yeah.
And say, this is what you do. Here's my return to run program. Just follow this. Well, that doesn't make sense if it's a bone stress injury that's a grade one versus, say, coming off a grade four bone stress injury, you know, or a mild flare of knee pain versus someone who's had a raging tendinopathy for 3 months prior and is finally getting back to running. So I think the management or the magnitude of loading is very important between, is it a condition that is going to respond to load like tendinopathy does, and we know that, versus more of something that's more of an inflamed condition, and think of it as knee osteoarthritis. Let's just throw that in there, right? That one, if you load it too much, if you do heavy loading on it, it's going to flare up, right? So it's that balance between no load and too much load, trying to get that sweet spot for that particular condition. The loading is critical for the conditions that can tolerate it. But ultimately, if they're all getting back to running, how do you migrate them back? And I usually, exactly what you said, is some combination of walk-run is what I may start with. But where I start with that, is it 1 minute of running and 3 minutes of walking, and, you know, or two and two, or however, or is it 5 minutes of running and 30 seconds of walk? Wherever I start on that scale largely depends on the capacity of the individual, the significance of the injury they've had, their time loss away from activity, their injury history. And those are probably the biggest ones that come to mind, and then start them back on the run progression, and then being willing to adapt and modify that progression right away based on their response to it.
So is that your next research question? Is that algorithm that you can plug in on all those features? How far off? What's the running experience? What their loading tissue is? What their injury is? And then you plug all those in, and that gives
it
you
spits
the...
it out. Yeah, I know where you're going with this because you've tried that.
I have.
We've had this discussion many times about coming up with an algorithm for return to running. That is a real hard one, and it is, because it is so unique to those individual pieces. And unfortunately, there is no good science on this topic at all, because imagine doing an RCT, where you have to standardize the intervention. So you standardize your return to run protocol, right, on individuals, but you might be able to get away with that provided all the injury types and injuries are kind of the same in the population that you're studying and similar age and similar. It becomes really hard to do, right? It will take a long time to get that to happen. So anyway, no, it's not going to be my future research area.
I'm just teasing. Yeah, no, I get it. So I guess, we are kind of coming to the end here. We've got tons we could talk about, but what's your last pearl? What do you want to share, kind of wrap up with? You've kind of had a few good ones that you've kind of mentioned here, but anything else you want to kind of share is to wrap up to our listeners here. And knowing that, it's been 6 years since we started the podcast, so this may be the last time you have to share this for another 6 years if you're not willing to come on again for 6 years, so make it good.
No pressure there at all. Let's see what else. I think the last piece is make sure that it kind of falls under the listen area. And that is that the history of the individual will tell you a lot, and don't discount it or dismiss it or breeze over it and just go by what may be in their medical record from past. Make sure to really get a handle on what that looks like, and incorporate their goals into your plan of care, right? Every patient I see, I always ask, why are you here today? What do you want to accomplish with your visit today? It also helps me reframe it, because I'm thinking, I need to do X, Y, and Z because that's what they want. And reality is, they're like, no, I understand this is, you're not going to cure this, right? You're not going to take all my pain away. I just want to understand, is my running form okay? Or am I doing more damage? Or I just want to understand the basics of what I need to do to self-manage, knowing that the condition is not going to disappear immediately. So that really helps even for me to reframe it, and what pressures you put on yourself as a clinician in helping that patient.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian, for your time, for the pearls, for what you're doing in the research over the years and continue to do. And then just trying to spread the word about it, and make sure we have good care for our patients and in this field, particularly the runners, but in general, just want good care. And like you said, there's those blend, where this is medicine for running, and it's not different. So I'm going to recap them here. Don't overcomplicate, establish expectations, listen to the patients. History gives you a lot, and incorporate their goals. So the five pearls from B. Heiderscheidt here, we got it today. So that brings us to the end of today's podcast. On behalf of my co-host or guest, Brian Heiderscheidt, we'd like to thank you for tuning in. And as a reminder, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. And remember to check out the updates on the 2022 Mountain Land Running Summit, which is going to be September 29th through October 1st. You can check that out at summit.mlrehab.com. And as always, you can find more information on all the running medicine resources offered by Mountain Land Physical Therapy at mlrehab.com/run. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Exercises that are safe and appropriate for some people may not be for you. No treatment program should be undertaken without first consulting your physical therapist or physician. The contents of this podcast is protected under United States copyright laws, and may not be reproduced, redistributed, transmitted, displayed, published, or broadcast without prior written permission of Mountain Land Physical Therapy.